here, and I'm experimenting again. And as far as I'm aware, this is the first attempt that I'm making of doing a live church history reading. I'm wanting to read through Smiley's History of the Covenant, as it's called, Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smiley, spelled Smiley but pronounced Smiley. And this is a really, really important history. I'm sitting here in a very pleasant part of Scotland. Yet not far from here, for example, there is Dunnottar Castle, where so many godly men and women who were covenanters suffered for their faith. And we could do well to read up on the covenanters in these days, because they were living in times where they were hunted and pursued for their faith and for their faithfulness to the word of God. And that may well be true of many of us in days to come. It's a story of remarkable deliverances, of great suffering, of great trials, and of great perseverance, and of coming through and standing firm, even unto death, for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, this is chapter 2 of the book Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smiley. Chapter 1 I put up yesterday on sermonaudio.com, and that dealt with the restoration of the monarchy in England and Scotland in 1660, at the return of Charles II, or the enthronement of Charles II in London. And this set the stage for the new era of covenanting persecution. Interesting that I'm reading this week, because this is the week, of course, when Charles III will be enthroned, and it is yet to be seen what kind of king he will be. But already he's discounting the Christian faith, discounting the truth of the Bible, and seeking to put all religions on some kind of level, which is not what he should do as a constitutional monarch. His duty is to uphold the Protestant Christian religion, but we're concerning ourselves with events of in the 1660s, and we are going to read about the Drunken Parliament, a very important chapter, because this Drunken Parliament set the stage for the persecution that was to follow, and this was in Scotland. Now, today I was out preaching in the open air. I was able to preach in three towns, in Blairgowrie, Kirriemuir and Forfar, towns that I haven't preached in before, towns that have got some Christian witness, nevertheless. Small towns, very small towns, and on each of those occasions, the Lord blessed me and gave me conversations, significant conversations with individuals. I put all three of those open-air recordings up on Sermon Audio, and I will probably put the last one from Forfar up on YouTube as well. So, Chapter 2 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smiley, The Drunken Parliament. At the Restoration, Scotland continued essentially Presbyterian. Why, it may be asked, was Presbyterianism practically so helpless from the moment that Charles took the management of affairs? The rulers he chose for his northern dominion, rulers with all his own dislike of religion, mounted to power with scarcely so much as a protest on the part of the people. It seems singular that the transition should be made so smoothly. Hitherto, Presbytery had been queenly and forceful. Her sceptre had swayed rich and poor, merchant and soldier, old and young. She had moulded creed and conduct. She had given to the citizens the priceless boon of good education. She had fought successfully against the encroachments of royalty. She had schooled the unruly nobles into apparent decorousness. She had leavened the rank and file of the nation with the truths she taught and the enthusiasms she inspired. That's Presbyterianism. Yet the diadem passed from her, as it were, in a night. In 1660, Charles did what he pleased with the Church of Scotland. And the old remonstrances and defiances, if they were heard, were but feeble and futile. Can't help thinking about the Church of Scotland today and her feeble and futile condition, because she has forsaken the truth of the gospel and brought in things which are contrary to the word of God. Hence, the Church of Scotland today is not only failing, but is under God's wrath because of her infidelity to the word of God. Very, very sad, grieved by that with all my heart. But there were reasons for an impotence so remarkable. One of them, probably the most operative, was that the Church was no longer a unity. Mournful divisions played havoc with her strength. To resolutioner and protester, the cardinal verities were the same, and there was comparatively little to drive them into antagonism. But they were too apt to concentrate their debates and energies on their disagreements and not on their concords. The resolutioner regarded his neighbour as a precisian. The protester saw in his co-religionist a latitudinarian who might join hands with the enemy. And I think in these two groups we would have the groups of the liberal liberalising faction within the Church of Scotland and the faithful faction, the faction faithful to the cause of Christ. Here was an infatuating and ruining distemper which intruded into synod and presbytery and kirk session, and the very homes were preeminently fortunate which were not embittered by its poison. It must be granted also that the Covenanters had failed to gain the affection of numbers of the men of rank and title. They had their princes of the chariot, but the larger proportion of their adherents came from the middle class and from the peasantry. Many of the nobles were hostile, earls and barons and knights, with lives which were only too ungoverned and rough, with private sins that they wished to keep undisturbed. Resented the faithfulness of the Church's rebukes and the supervision she tried to exercise over their households and manners. During her halcyon days, they yielded an outward submission, but with the king's star in the ascendant, they could discard their pretended meekness and could flout their instructor. There was a third source from which trouble flowed to the Kirk. It was the desperate poverty of the ruling families in the country. In 1654, Robert Bailey writes, with pitiful emphasis of our racked nobility, Dukes Hamilton, the one execute, the other slain, their state forfault. Huntly, there is more debt on the house nor the land can pay. Dowglass and his son Angus are quite men of no respect. Marshall, Rothes, Eglinton, and his three sons, Crawford, Lauderdale, and other prisoners in England, and their lands sequestrate or gifted to English soldiers. Balmerinock, suddenly dead, and his son for public debt keeps not the causey. Thus, from one depressing item to another, the black catalogue moves on, but the restoration brought to these impoverished lords the chance of escape from their bankruptcy. It offered them forfeited estates and places of consequence. To those who have just arrived, we're reading On the Drunken Parliament from Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smellie. We may be sorry, but we cannot be surprised that some of them were quick to accept the glittering bribe. For a handful of silver, silver very urgently needed, they abandoned a church for which they had never entertained profound regard. So it came about that Presbytery, whose trumpet had blown such far-sounding blasts, triumphant and admonitory, was all but silent at the crisis when her adversaries prevailed. Their victory was indisputable. For a few months in the autumn of 1660, Charles ruled Scotland through the old Committee of Estates. But on the New Year's Day of 1661, a Scottish Parliament met in Edinburgh. 9 years had passed since a similar meeting, and the men who assembled at the King's call were vastly different from their predecessors. They had been carefully selected, so that obnoxious members might be excluded. History seems to repeat itself with the Scottish Parliament. The House could be trusted to prove itself a pliant instrument. Before this fateful Parliament rose on the 12th of July, it had turned Scottish history into new channels as momentously as when Cyrus changed the course of the Euphrates on the night that he and his Persians captured Babylon. You can read about that night where the writing is on the wall in the Book of Daniel. And the people in Babylon thought that they were unassailable because they lived in Babylon, which was protected by the Euphrates River. They didn't reckon with Cyrus rerouting the river so that they could then enter the city underneath through the course of the former water course and take over the city. But you can read about that in the Book of Daniel. At least not, you can't read the actual mechanism, but you can read about the fall of the Emperor of Babylon on that night. So here we have this new parliament in Scotland in 1661, which is in the king's pocket, in the king's hand. Commissioner of Charles, who directed the Parliament, whose name stands foremost in public affairs for a year or two, was John, Earl of Middleton. He was one of those soldiers of fortune who occupied themselves too busily in national concerns and who were, for the most part, without either human pity or religious faith. He had carved his way to the front by his military ability. Originally poor, he sought distinction in foreign service, and we hear of him as a pikeman in Colonel Hepburn's regiment in France. Returning to his own country, he was so zealous anent the covenant that when he took it and held up his right hand, he wished that that right arm might be his death, if ever he should forget his vow. It was under the blue banner that he fought in the campaigns of 1644 and 1645. And David Leslie had not many subordinates whom he held in greater esteem. But then he veered round. When Charles was in Scotland in the months preceding Worcester, Major Middleton was his close friend. Throughout the reign of the Commonwealth, he missed no opportunity of striking a blow for the absent prince. He commanded the Moss troopers, who for a time kept the flame of revolt blazing in the Highlands. But in the spring of 1654, at Dalnaspiddle, near the head of Loch Garry, he was overtaken and beaten by Colonel Morgan. Now, when Puritanism was shorn of her pride, Middleton became a peer of the realm and the king's representative in Scotland, so he was a turncoat. He was a fearless officer, and he had gone cheerfully through perils and imprisonments for his sovereign. But the man of camps and battles was too violent, too arbitrary, too revengeful to be a wise civil governor. He had a temper which could not bear opposition. His tastes were coarse, and his habits, even in an age not over nice, were noticeably gross and brutish. He was seldom sober, seldom away from his boon companions. It was a mad, roaring time, full of extravagance, Gilbert Burnet writes. And no wonder it was so, when the men of affairs were almost perpetually drunk. The commissioner's judgment was beclouded, and his passions inflamed, and his heart hardened by constant dissipation. As for living belief, he did not know what it meant. Robert Woodrow has a story which shows him as a free thinker in whom bluster and superstition commingled. And by living belief, we're talking about a living, saving faith in Jesus Christ. In Hamilton's army in 1648, the minister of Eastwood narrates, Middleton had for bosom friend a certain Laird of Balbegno, the neighbour of his family in Kincardineshire. It was within a week of the fight at Preston, and the two were talking of the risks in front. If there is a battle, Middleton suggested, what if we are killed? What will become of us? No matter, the other answered. We shall be free from our vexations hereaway. But his comrade was not quite convinced that we drink of Lethe at last and eat of lotus. What if there is a future world, he retorted, and a future life? It was an empty fable of the minister's, Balbegno replied, and Middleton avowed his sympathy. So they denied what God says in his word, that after death comes judgment. But suppose, he went on, that things should turn out otherwise. So they made a compact that if one died, he should return, if that were possible, from the land of mystery to inform the survivor of what he discovered there. We can't pass over to those who are alive once we are dead. At Preston, Balbegno fell. For a while, Middleton forgot the bargain, until one night he was sitting alone, a captive in the Tower of London. Two sentinels guarded his room. He had been listlessly turning over the pages of a Bible which he had found in the chamber, for what end he knew not, it having been so little his custom, when, lifting his head and looking to the door, he saw a man standing in the shadow. "Who is there?" he asked, and the answer came. "Balbegno." "That cannot be," he declared, "for I saw Balbegno buried after he was slain in battle." The ghostly visitor glided forward and reminded him of their agreement and caught his arm. Now, of course, I'm very credulous about this. Or incredulous, such a thing was really happened. A hand laid in his, Middleton told afterwards, was hot and soft, just as it used to be, and Balbegno in his ordinary likeness. "I am permitted to stay 1 hour," the apparition said, "so let us sit down and put your watch before us." In the weird interview, the prisoner learned many things: how he should escape from his dungeon, how the king was to be restored, how at court favour and honour awaited him, but how at length the sunshine was to be clouded over with calamitous eclipse. Then, when the hour was done, Balbegno rose and took his leave and lingered for an instant amongst the shadows at the door, and so disappeared. I'm sorry, I just don't believe that. But it's a good story. This was the man who guided Scotland. bold in the din of the fight and true to his king, but not a happy warrior. Unbelieving, boorish, roistering, others of kindred temperament helped him. The Earl of Glencairn was Chancellor, and he was royalist to the backbone. Sir Archibald Primrose filled the office of Clerk Register. His were the shrewdest intellect and the cleverest tongue in the Parliament House. He had an art of speaking to all men according to their sense of things, and so drew out their secrets, while he concealed his own, for words went for nothing with him. The King's advocate was Sir John Fletcher, in whose veins was none of the milk of kindness. He hated all mild proceedings and could scarce speak with decency or patience to those of the other side. It mattered little that Lord Crawford, who was earnest in his Presbyterianism, was treasurer. His advice was overborne by the clamours of the rest. Within a few years, the commissioner, drugged by the sweets of power, as well as by fiery liquors, was to cross swords with a man clear-eyed and stronger-willed than himself, and was to be worsted in the duel. Balbegno's gloomier auguries were fulfilled as surely as his gladsomer predictions. Until that moment of disaster, Middleton and his allies might do whatever they chose. They made abundant use of their chances. During its session of 6.5 months, the Parliament of 1661 passed no less than 393 acts. It would have been extraordinary if, in so long a list, there were not some beneficent measures. It is curious to note that means were adopted to safeguard the observance of the Sabbath and to prevent profane swearing and excessive drinking. Now and then Satan discloses himself as the unexpected reprover of sin. But Middleton's first session is remembered by other achievements than these. His great design and business was to make the king absolute. And to reach this end, the framers of the laws in Scotland had to demolish the outworks and bulwarks of the church and to blow up her government itself. Their aim was to re-establish despotism and to destroy presbytery. There were no boundaries to the powers with which they invested the king. Their earliest proceeding was to construct an oath of allegiance, an oath in which every jurisdiction except that of His Majesty was renounced. Its terms said nothing about Charles's right to interfere with the church. The omission and the ambiguity were deliberate, for meanwhile it seemed prudent to veil some of the tyrannies which the future would bring to light. But under cover of its clauses, the authors of the oath intended to violate the domain of conscience and to attack the household of Christ. In coming years, it was to be an effective weapon of persecution. The fidelity of men and women to the crown was to be tested by their willingness to swear its sentences. And if they had any scruples, no mercy was shown. Some of you might be aware that in England this week, or in the United Kingdom this week, there's been this controversy because King Charles's coronation next week, the nation was to be given the opportunity to swear allegiance to the king. But the Archbishop of Canterbury has now gone to great lengths to say that it's voluntary. So in some respects, time has changed, but we have yet to see what the new monarchy will become in these days. But back then, you had to have absolute allegiance to the crown, or you would be dealt with ruthlessly. No scruples, no mercy was shown. Further still, the Parliament went in subservience to the sovereign. It decreed that he alone could choose his officers of state, his privy councillors, his lords of session, that he alone could call and hold and prorogue and dissolve all conventions and meetings, that he alone could enter into leagues and treaties, that he alone could proclaim peace or war. His was to be the voice of a god rather than that of a man. The members set apart the 29th of May, the day of the glorious return, to be forever an holy day unto the Lord. Its opening hours were to be consecrated to prayer, preaching, thanksgiving and praise. Its afternoon and evening were to be spent in lawful divertissements suitable for so solemn an occasion. We can perceive to what license the gates were unbarred by this statute, and why it staggered the friends of the covenant, who kept their garland of sanctity for God's Sabbath, and cherished an invincible mistrust of man-made festivals. One consummate folly placed the copestone on the Parliament's excess of loyalty. It voted Charles an annual grant of £40,000 sterling, and thus exhausted the resources of a nation which required every penny of its money. 4 years later, the Earl of Tweedale, a nobleman with some love for his country, wrote that a Dutch invasion would be for Scotland a much less serious evil than the smallest increase in the taxation of the people. But Middleton and Glencairn and Sir Archibald Primrose were dominated by other ideas. For the benefit of their royal and wasteful master, they would pauperise the whole community. As James Curtin described it, they installed their king a sort of pope. But what filled many hearts with keener sorrow than this servility towards the monarch was the treatment meted out to the church. In decision after decision, Parliament heaped insult on the covenant. It annulled the proceedings of the Convention of Estates, which had sworn the Solemn League. It protested that the great bond, which had in Scotland universal respect next to the Scripture, was without public and permanent obligation. Then, growing in hardihood, the leaders had recourse to a masterstroke. By a general recessory act carried on the 28th of March after a single debate, they revoked the pretended parliaments kept in the years 1640, 1641, 1644, 1645, 1646, hello Rico, the Lord bless you, online there, 1645, 1646, 1647 and 1648, and all acts and deeds passed and done in them. In other words, they were undoing the work of the Reformation, declaring the same to be henceforth void and null. When the notion was mooted first, it seemed too big, too venturesome, a goal too desirable for attainment. It appeared so choking that it was laid aside. But when one drastic measure after another secured a glib consent, Middleton returned to the darling scheme and hurried it through the nerveless and recreant House. We've never seen ungodly laws passed through in a hurry here in Scotland. It seems that this is history repeating itself. What did he gain by it? The cancelling of everything that successive legislators, in which the Presbyterian element predominated, had effected for the church. The right to pronounce disloyal and traitorous those who should still assert their attachment to the flag of the Second Reformation. The construction of a high road by which the bishops might ride back triumphant. Indeed, the commissioner would have pushed on immediately to the creation of his hierarchy. But astute Sir Archibald Primrose counselled a pause. Bring the bishops in, he advised. Let it be done surely, but let it likewise be done slowly. The wary clerk register won his point for the time with his more headstrong chief. But whenever the act recessory had received the imprimatur of Parliament, the end was in sight. It could not be many months until the mitre and lawn sleeves of the prelate, that's the bishops, displaced the modest Geneva gown of the minister. At the end, if you'd like to ask a question, Nico, or you can contact me by the email link on Sermon Audio, on my page on Sermon Audio of my name. I'm going to carry on reading. The Lord bless you, Nico, and help you in whatever way that you need help at this time. These were the doings of the Drunken Parliament, as it has been nicknamed ever since. For often it was when they were stupefied by their carousels that the senators decided on their revolutionary enactments. They robbed the nation of its liberties. They checked its social progress. They did what they could to stifle its religious life, and their sorry victory was procured. When wine had stolen from them brain and conscience and patriotism, and most things worth keeping, Bishop Burnet's epithets are not too severe. It was a mad, roaring time. One day, when such melancholy events were happening, David Dixon, who had been minister in Irvine and was now professor in Edinburgh, and who wrote some verses not yet forgotten, "O Mother, dear Jerusalem," went to expostulate with the Earl of Middleton, but the King's Commissioner was hugely offended. He told his monitor that he was mistaken if he thought to overawe him. He was no coward to tremble before a priest. "For 23 years, the old man replied, "I have known that you are no coward ever since the Brigadier in the June of 1638. It was a home thrust, for in that past, Midsummer Middleton's sword had been unsheathed in defence of the Covenant." The Earl had no answer, and the minister pleaded with him to pay regard, if not to the Presbytery, at least to those 42 members of Parliament who had dared to dissent from the Recessory Act. "And, my lord," he added, "I would put you in mind of that deep exercise of soul under which you lay in St. Andrew's in 1645 when you were sick and in hazard of death." "What," Middleton sneered, "do you presume to speak to me of a fit of fever? So pained to the heart, David Dixon turned and left the room. The night was to grow darker, moonless, starless, hopeless, before there was a streak of day. So this was the drunken parliament, and this was to be a time of astonishingly severe persecution for the people of God. That was the stage set. They would bring in the absolute power of the king and bishops in place of the presbytery. Greetings, HW, and welcome everybody. So the next chapter, which I'll read, I don't think it'll be for a couple of days at least, is chapter 3, of course, a deathbed in St. Andrews. So I really believe that we do well to read up on the covenants. It helps us, instructs us, and prepares us also, because we're looking at, I think, what we could call a new covenanting era in Scotland, England, and Wales. Yes, so I'm going to leave it there and say goodnight. I'm going to leave just a few seconds if anybody wants to ask a question or anything like that. I'm more than willing to try and do what I can to answer it. But other than that, I continue to pray for Scotland, continue to pray for the people of Scotland and for the church in Scotland, that there would be a revival of religion and that the Lord would return his presence to this nation. Thank you very much, Hayley. The Lord bless you and be with you. And Michelle, thank you. Good night.